Translation purple, Srila Prabhupada. O Lord, you are the master of the entire universe. What have you not given to us? You have entered the core of our hearts and dissipated the darkness of our ignorance by your effulgence. This is the supreme gift. We do not need a material donation. When Dhruva Maharaj was offered a benediction by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he replied, O my Lord, I am fully satisfied. I do not need any material benediction. Similarly, when Prahlad Maharaj was offered a benediction by Lord Nrsingadev, he also refused to accept it and instead declared that a devotee should not be like a vanik, a mercantile man, who gives something in exchange for some profit. One who becomes a devotee for some material profit is not a pure devotee. Brahmanas are always enlightened by the Supreme Personality of Godhead within the heart. Sarvasya chaham hridi shanivisto matarsmitya gyanam apohanam cha. And because the Brahmanas and Vaishnavas are always directed by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, they are not greedy for material wealth. What is absolutely necessary they possess, but they do not want an expanded kingdom. An example of this was given by Vamanadev. Acting as a brahmachari, Lord Vamanadev wanted only three paces of land. Aspiring to possess more and more for personal sense gratification is simply ignorance. And this ignorance is conspicuous by its absence from the heart of a brahmana or Vaishnava. Apratam nastaya kimnu bhagavan bhuvaneshvara yandanta hridayam vishya tamoham sisvarochisa. O Lord, you are the master of the entire universe. What have you not given to us? You have entered the core of our hearts and dissipated the darkness of our ignorance by your effulgence. This is the supreme gift. We do not need a material donation. So, Hare Krishna. So this is a very nice verse and purport to speak on. There's lots of things to talk about. Thank you. Lots of things to discuss in this section. So here, as we know, Lord Ramchandra has given charity to the brahmanas. And being qualified brahmanas, they have offered everything back to him. Thank you, Prabhu. So, as Srila Prabhupada says, a brahmana needs nothing and wants nothing from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So the statements in this verse, statements by these brahmanas, are confirmed in Bhagavad Gita, in a Chatur Shloki. It says, you are the master of the entire universe. Krishna says, Aham Sarvasya Prabhavo, Mata Sarvam Pravartate, Itima Papajanti, Mam Buddha Bhava Samanvitaha. The last of those four verses, Chatur Shloki, Tesham Evanukam Partha Mahamma Gyana Jantamaha, Nashi Yami Abhavasto Gyana Dipena Bashuta. So Krishna enlightens the devotee from within the heart, as the brahmanas say here, dissipating the darkness of our ignorance by your effulgence. This is your supreme gift. So a brahmana acts only for his own purification. Doesn't do anything for any mundane or materialistic outcome. Whatever he does is just for his own purification. So a Vaishnava only worships Krishna for his own purification and ultimately out of love. So, one, as Prabhupada says in the purport here, a devotee should not be a vanik, right? Shouldn't be a mercantile man who worships Krishna for some material benediction. So, many people do. People come here every day and pray to Krishna for some sort of material benediction, for wealth, success. In India, a very famous temple is Balaji, Tirupati Balaji. People will go there, they'll make business transactions with Balaji, right? They'll say, Krishna, if you make me successful, I'll give you X amount of money, I'll give you so many rupees, I'll give you half of my business, I'll give you this, I'll give you that, if you make me successful. So there's some exchange going on, right? Some give and take with Krishna. They'll give to Krishna if Krishna gives to them. But as Srila Prabhupada points out, this is not the mentality of a pure devotee. A pure devotee doesn't want anything from Krishna, he only wants to give, to serve. So a brahmana is qualified by the mode of goodness. Brahmana is situated fully in the mode of goodness. So the mode of passion is typified by desire. Someone who's in the mode of passion, they want things. They want stuff. They want to get things as much as possible. More and more. So a person in the mode of goodness, he's not interested in those things. He's not interested in acquiring the material. It's in Bhagavad Gita, in the 14th chapter, obviously, we know, Krishna discusses the three modes of material nature at length. And it's very interesting what Krishna says in this in the purport. Srila Prabhupada says in the purport. In the first verse of the chapter of the three modes of material nature, Krishna says, the Supreme Personality of Godhead says, again, I shall declare to you this supreme wisdom, the best of all knowledge, knowing which all the sages have attained the supreme perfection. So Krishna is saying, by understanding this philosophy of the three modes of material nature, you can attain the supreme perfection. So this is one part of, let's say, Vedic philosophy, Krishna's philosophy, that can be scientifically verified, right? I don't know if anybody knows a devotee called Dhira Govinda. He did a PhD thesis all about the three modes of material nature, and he performed scientific experiments to show how the three modes of material nature influence people and how by cultivating a particular mode, one develops particular qualities, right? It can be scientifically understood by experimentation. You can see how the modes of material nature work by associating with different things. We take on those particular qualities, right? So, Srila Prabhupada explains in the purport that by understanding this philosophy of the three modes, you can actually attain liberation. He says, this knowledge is far, far superior to all other processes of knowledge thus far explained. And knowing this, many attain perfection. Thus it is expected that one who understands this 14th chapter will attain perfection. Right? So, there's a discussion, there's a debate sometimes between devotees, whether you should just engage yourself in devotional service, whether you should just throw yourself into, you know, bhakti and forget about all these things, like don't worry about cultivating the mode of goodness. We don't need to cultivate the mode of goodness. What we have to do is just do service and then Krishna will take care of the rest. We'll just follow the program, right? Follow the program, Prabhu. Just follow the program and everything will happen automatically. And some devotees say, no, what you need to do is cultivate. Right, you have to consciously cultivate sattva-gun. You have to develop these qualities. Right, you have to develop brahmanical qualities, and you have to consciously make an effort to elevate yourself. So, some years ago, about 20 years ago or so, I don't know if anyone remembers, there was a book written by Kundalini Prabhu called "The Nectar of Discrimination." Does anyone remember that book? No. It was called "The Nectar of Discrimination." Right. So it was all about that. It was all about the modes of nature and how you need to discriminate, right? Your devotee has to be constantly aware of what you're doing. Constantly aware of what you're doing, and constantly focused on how what you're doing will affect your consciousness. Right? So when you're living in the temple, it's relatively easy because you're surrounded by devotees. Everything around you, you know, whatever you're going to eat, it's prasadam. You're always going to see the deity. There's always kirtan going on. Devotees are never going to let you get into, you know, too much illusion. But if you're living outside in the world, it becomes much more of a problem because you're always associating with different modes. All right? Like, just to get here in the morning, you have to get into a car. Right? Car means, you know, rajagun, tamagun. You're going to get out on the roads and everyone's angry and people are frustrated. You know, it's a tamasic environment. So how do you live in that world and not be influenced by it? So it requires a kind of a constant dedication, like a retuning. You have to be constantly aware. What am I doing now? What am I looking at? Right? You're driving down the street. What am I looking at? How is this going to affect me? Is this going to put me in a mode of passion? Is this going to put me in a mode of ignorance? Am I going to put the radio on and listen to some music? I'm going to be in the mode of passion, right? So it requires a constant attention to avoid being influenced by the lower modes of nature. So, like I said, the other side of the argument is that you just do bhakti. You just throw yourself in. Like, I used to travel with Tribhuvanath Prabhu, right? About 4 years I was with Tribhuvanath Prabhu. And Tribhuvanath was, actually, he was completely the opposite. He didn't really particularly agree with that argument that you have to develop sattva-gun and that you have to spend time cultivating. He was just into, just throw yourself into it, just do bhakti. Just go out on Harinam, 8 hours a day Harinam, do a festival, preach, travel, just do what you have to do. Just do your service and you will be elevated, all right? So there's something to be said for both arguments, right? If you're able to throw yourself into devotional service in the way that somebody like Tribhuvanath Prabhu was, he was the kind of person who gave 100%, right? Just threw himself into it. If he was leading a kirtan, he's leading a kirtan, 100% energy, completely absorbed in what he was doing with full vigor. So yeah, if you're doing that all the time, then you can transcend the modes of material nature. The last verse of this chapter says, Mamcha yovi abhicharina bhakti yoga ne sevate sagunan samatichatam brahma bhuyaya kalpate. Right? Is that one who is fully engaged in devotional service at once transcends the modes of material nature and comes to the level of Brahman. But the important word there is fully engaged. It's a question of how engaged you are in devotional service, right? If you're engaged in devotional service 50% of the time, then you're not going to transcend the modes. You'll be 50% in the modes. Or if you're 10% devoted to bhakti, then 90% of your 90% of your conscience is still left at the victim of the modes of nature, right? At the mercy of the modes. So this philosophy, if you like, that devotees are transcendental is, yeah, it's true, devotees are transcendental. But devotees are transcendental to the extent that they're engaged in devotional service. So again, if you're in the temple, your life is focused on devotional service, right? But if you're out there, like myself later on, I'm gonna go home, I'm gonna get changed, I'm gonna take off these nice things and put on some, you know, karmi clothes, and I'm gonna go to work, right? And I'm gonna get in my car and drive up the A41. And, you know, people are going to be cutting me in and be road raging. And, you know, I mean, my work is not too bad. I work in a library, which is about as exciting as it sounds. But, you know, it could be worse. I mean, anyway, I'll talk about that. So, I think, to a certain extent, it can be potentially a dangerous philosophy to just think that devotees are transcendental, to think that we're more transcendental than we actually are. To be transcendental, you know, means to be fully established in your siddha-deha, right? To be fully aware of your constitutional position, to be fully established in your spiritual self and fully absorbed in serving the Lord 24 hours a day. If you're in that state of consciousness, then no doubt you've completely transcended the modes and there's no need to consider cultivating the mode of goodness. You don't need to think about cultivating the mode of goodness. Excuse me. But if you're not 24 hours a day engaged fully in the devotional service of the Lord, then you know, you do need to be aware of these things because we are influenced by the world around us. So, you know, if devotees, sadhakas, are transcendental, then why did Krishna bother speaking about it in the Bhagavad Gita, right? He spoke about it for a reason, is that it needs to be paid attention to. Why do we have Varnashram? Varnashram is an institution, like Daivi Varnashram is for the Vaishnavas. So it's there for a reason, is that we need to cultivate higher qualities, right? A person, like a Paramahamsa, doesn't need to cultivate the mode of goodness by practicing the Varnashram system. But sadhakas, aspiring Vaishnavas, they need to be engaged in service according to their material propensities. You need to work according to your body and your mind. So this is Varnashram. Deity worship also is designed for elevating you to the mode of goodness by making you become very clean, forcing you to become regulated. Right? This is all about developing sattva-gun. So in sattva-gun, you can begin to understand spirituality, right? I mean, as Krishna describes, the qualities of the different modes. And their effects. The mode of goodness, being purer than the others, is illuminating. It frees one from all sinful reactions. Those situated in that mode become conditioned by a sense of happiness and knowledge. All right. So, we want to be conditioned by a sense of happiness and knowledge. If you're going to be conditioned, it's better to be conditioned by happiness and knowledge, which is, right, a building block towards transcendence, whereas the mode of passion is born of unlimited desires and longings, which is not very conducive for spiritual life, right? You don't want to be conditioned by desires and longings, and you certainly don't want to be conditioned by darkness, which results in madness, indolence, and sleep. Not very conducive. So, as long as we are on the material plane, we need to be aware of those modes and how they're affecting us. So, yes, 2 days ago, Prabhu Kartik Chandra, right? Kartik Chandra, who was giving a very nice class, and he was speaking about the brahmanas, the duties of the brahmanas, and he was giving some very nice information about yajnik brahmanas and the different priests and how they chant the different sections of the Vedas. So these 6 duties of the brahmanas, yatan, yatan, patan, pajan, dan, pratigraha, all right? It's quite interesting that when we think of those 6 duties of a brahmana, I don't know about you, but at least for myself, I tend to think in terms of Vedic brahmanas, right? So we think, okay, yajna, performing yajna and teaching others how to do yajna. So chanting mantras, performing fire sacrifices, right? That's yajna. But actually, as we know, this is Kali Yuga. So yajnai sankirtanai praheya yajanti hisa medisaha. Kali Yuga, the Yuga Dharma is Samkirtan, all right? So a Kali Yuga Brahmana should be teaching the Kali Yuga Dharma, all right? Which is Sankirtan. So teaching others how to engage in devotional service, teaching others how to engage in congregational chanting. That's the Yuga Dharma for this age. That's the sacrifice for this age, right? So we should be practicing that and teaching that. So the most simple way we engage people in learning, we teach others how to engage in Sankirtan, is by going out on Sankirtan ourselves. So in Kali Yuga, that's our position as aspiring Vaishnavas or Brahmanas, is to teach others how to perform Sankirtan Yajna. So if we perform Sankirtan Yajna, if we go out on the street, chant, all right, then others will see. And not that they're going to accept us. Brahmanas are the intellectual heads of society, right? The leaders of society. But I don't think many people in the world think of us as being the intellectual heads of society. I think if you ask most people, they'll say, Harry who? All right. They don't know who we are at all. But if they have heard of us, they think, oh yeah, the Happy Harrys or something like that. I don't think, I don't think David Cameron is going to be coming to the temple anytime soon to ask for counsel from a council of brahmanas about how should he, should he go into Syria and Iraq and should he fight with ISIS or what should he do in this situation? How should he counteract Islamic fundamentalism? He's not going to come to ask us, right? So we don't necessarily have that position as intellectual leaders of society. But that's something that we should be cultivating, right? We should be cultivating that wisdom so that if people, somebody does ask, even if it's just somebody we meet on the street, right? Devotees distribute books, go on the street. In a small way, we can act as a spiritual guide, a spiritual leader, guiding people in the right direction. So, in this day and age, the dominant philosophical system in this day and age now is atheism, right? If you watch any kind of documentary, or sometimes when I'm driving, I listen to Radio 4, right? And in Radio 4, they talk, you know, kind of talking about the issue of the day, current affairs, that kind of thing. And anyone who expresses anything which, how can I put it? Anyone who expresses an opinion which is based on religious faith is considered to be quite foolish, right? You're considered to be very sentimental, very stupid, downright foolish. Because especially this kind of culture of new atheism, Richard Dawkins, people like that, they wanted to rebrand atheism as the smarts. They wanted to call themselves the smarts. Because they consider themselves to be the most elevated or, you know, intellectual people in society, is the atheists, because they've transcended the shackles of religion. They've left that behind. And they've become free from that. Right? They've become free from these... Thanks. They've become free from these outdated, old-fashioned ideas about worshipping God, bowing down, surrendering oneself to some kind of supernatural deity. But that's because there isn't information. Right? When people talk about God or religion, they're talking about Christianity, Islam, Judaism, right? And, you know, if you look at the behavior of Christians, Jews, and to some extent, and Muslims, then you can understand why people don't like religion. It's understandable. You know, religious people behave in ways which are crazy. They're fighting each other, killing each other, going to war over religion. All right? These are, you know, it's crazy. It's madness. So it's unsurprising that people who are intellectually inclined have rejected all of that because they don't have an alternative. So our duty, our position in society, is to offer an alternative. Somehow or other, we have to be able to give an alternative. We have to say, no. You don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? You can reject. Actually, you should reject mundane religion. Dharma, projita, kaitava, chaparama, right? You should reject mundane. Srimad Bhagavatam kicks out mundane religion, cheating religion. But real religion, the real true religion, the actual relationship of the soul with the Supreme Soul, that should be understood. And, you know, for thousands of years, that culture has been there in India, and nobody outside, nobody in the West knew. But now, time has come for people to understand that. As Srila Prabhupada said, it's about Srimad Bhagavatam is to bring about a revolution in the impious minds of the world's misguided civilization. Right? So the world is misguided. The intellectual heads are simply pointing people in the wrong direction. The religious leaders are simply exploiting the people, picking the pockets of the populace for their own benefit, right? Benefiting their friends in the corporate world, the bankers, right? Those in high finance. Those are the people who are dominating the world now. Vaishyas, Kshatriyas. There are no Brahmanas. So, gradually, we have to develop, we have to take that position. And nobody's going to give us that position. Nobody's going to say, okay, we need Brahmanas, please enlighten us. We have to actually put ourselves in that position. We have to be more forward. Right? Traditionally, in Vedic culture, people don't... the Brahmanas are not pushing themselves forward. People go to the Brahmanas. All right? People go to the Brahmanas for enlightenment. People approach a guru for enlightenment. But nobody's going to approach a guru nowadays. People are not interested in that. In the 1960s, when Srila Prabhupada came, there was a culture whereby all the young people, they wanted a guru. They were interested in Indian spirituality. They were attracted to yoga. They were attracted to meditation. They wanted to know about Indian culture, and they wanted to have a guru. But that culture's gone. Within the youth, everybody's just totally materialistic now. Nobody's interested anymore. All they want to do is go to and study business studies at university and become wealthy and get riches, get things, right? Because that's the dominant culture. It's extremely rajasic. So we have to be in a position to offer something else, offer an alternative. So we have to make Krishna consciousness as attractive as possible, right? When we go out on Harinam, we go out on book distribution, do these things, we have to make that an attractive thing. So people see it and think, rather than just think, okay, these people are a little bit crazy, I'm not going to get involved with them. We have to chant in such a way that people say, maybe there is something more to this. Maybe there's something that we need to understand. Right? So on Monday is Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati's appearance day. And regarding brahmanas, it's quite interesting. Previously, in Vaishnav culture, before the time of Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, those who were brahmanas, those who were from Brahmin families, they would remove their Brahmin threads when they took Vaishnav initiation. But Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, he initiated the principle of Vaishnavas taking second initiation, taking the Brahmin thread. So rather than Brahminical, you know, Brahmanas who were born in Brahmin, sorry, devotees who were born in Brahminical families taking off their Brahmin threads, he started initiating non-Brahmins into the sacred thread. So we know he got a lot of, he invoked a lot of anger in the Brahminical community for that. But, so it's a question. Why did he do that? Because in one sense, it's better if you just forget about the Varnashram system. It's easier. You just say, well, Vaishnava the Paramahamsas, once you're initiated into Vaishnava mantras, you're just practicing devotional service, you're on the bhakti marg, and you don't need that. So I was considering that Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati is kind of paving the way for a worldwide institution when he started giving non-Brahmanas, Vaishnavas from Sudra backgrounds, he started giving them Brahmin Diksha. Because if you're going to have a worldwide society, then you want to, I'm speculating, but I'm thinking that perhaps he wanted to create a platform whereby in a worldwide movement like ISKCON, people would see the Vaishnavas as Brahmanas, people would see the Vaishnavas as intellectual heads. So around the world, sorry, I've lost my thread here a little bit, excuse me. So, in a worldwide movement, you're going to have foreign devotees, you're going to have devotees who are not from backgrounds within the Vedic culture. So, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati wanted to establish that foreign devotees, devotees from Shudra backgrounds, etc., are as qualified as brahmanas. So, in this purport, you'll see that Srila Prabhupada uses the words brahmana and Vaishnava interchangeably. He says, he says that aspiring to possess more and more for personal sense gratification is simply ignorance, and this ignorance is conspicuous by its absence from the heart of a brahmana or a Vaishnava. All right, so he's using the two things interchangeably. He's a brahmana or a Vaishnava. The two things are the same. So, over 100 years ago, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, he wrote this book called Brahmana and Vaishnava. I'm sure most of you are familiar with the incident that Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he saw that the smarters were disregarding the Vaishnavas. The Vaishnavas were not respected in society. The smarter brahmanas were disrespecting them, and they were taking the lead in society, taking that position. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he wanted to establish that the Vaishnavas are, regardless of their background, they're as good as the brahmanas. So he said, is there no one who can take on this work? Is there no one who will do this? So in response to his father's request, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati wrote this book. And then later on, there was, in 1911, There was a huge debate between the smartas, caste brahmanas, caste goswamis, and Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati. So Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati spoke for 3 days, and at the end of those 3 days, he completely defeated all the Brahmin pundits, all the caste goswamis. None of them were able to defeat his arguments. And at the end of his lecture, on the third day, all of the people in the audience, they were so impressed with Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati that they rushed towards him, they wanted to touch his feet, to the extent that the guards had to actually get him out of there. But they washed his feet, the security guards washed his feet, and then they threw the water onto the heads of all the people in the audience because they were so desperate to get his mercy. So, in this book, see, Bhaktisiddhanta, he also establishes this this connection, or the similarity between the Brahmanas and the Vaishnavas. He says, while ascertaining the qualification for the Kanishtha Adhikari's worship of Lord Vishnu, Shudasnatan Goswami Prabhu has concluded that although according to the concocted remarks of some envious smartas, only seminal Brahmanas are qualified to worship Shalagram, and uninitiated women and Shudras are not qualified, if a person, regardless of Varna, is initiated into Vishnu mantras by a bona fide spiritual master, he is qualified to worship Sri Shalagram. Because according to the scriptures, Vaishnavas are accepted as equal to Brahmanas, even in ordinary consideration. In this regard, Srila Sanatana Goswami Prabhu has quoted many scriptural statements in his Digdarshini Tika to prove this point. For example, he has quoted the statement of Lord Kapila from his conversation with Devahuti in Srimad Bhagavatam 3.33.6. To say nothing of the spiritual advancement of persons who see the Supreme face to face, even a person born in a family of dog-eaters immediately becomes eligible to perform Vedic sacrifices if he once utters the holy name of the Supreme Personality of Godhead or chants about him, hears about his pastimes, offers him obeisances, or even remembers him. Excuse me. Again, from the topics of Prithu Maharaj in Srimad Bhagavatam 4.21.12, Srila Sanatana Goswami Prabhu has quoted, Maharaj Prithu was an unrivaled king and possessed the scepter for ruling all the seven islands on the surface of the globe. No one could destroy his irrevocable orders. Sorry. No one could disobey his irrevocable orders but the saintly persons, the brahmanas, and the descendants of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Vaishnavas. In other words, Maharaj Prithu treated the Brahmanas and the Vaishnavas with equal vision. Srila Goswami Prabhu has also quoted the statement of King Puranjan from Srimad Bhagavatam 4.26.24 as follows, O hero's wife, kindly tell me if someone has offended you. I am prepared to give such a person punishment as long as he does not belong to the Brahmana caste. But for the servant of Murariprabhu, Krishna, I excuse no one within or beyond these three worlds. No one can freely move after offending you, for I am prepared to punish him. In all these places, the Brahmanas and the Vaishnavas have been equally respected, even in worldly dealings. So this is something which is discussed later on in this chapter, is how no one can, the Vaishnavas or the Brahmanas are above punishment, above chastisement. So the king, the ruler, they're not allowed to chastise or punish the Brahmanas, they're above punishment. So ISKCON as an institution, it gives devotees Brahminical training, right? Devotees are trained as Brahmanas. Many times there's a lack of engagement for those. When you're in the temple, there's lots of service, there's lots of engagement. But once you move out of the temple, there can be a lack of engagement. So many devotees, they've passed through the ashram system and come out of the other side and found that there's not necessarily a focus or an engagement for their training. So something that needs to be developed. All right, Srila Prabhupada said, 50% of my work is not done in order to establish Varnashram. So a Varnashram community is a place where people can be engaged according to their natures. All right, so this is very important. Because once a devotee has passed through the ashram system and moved out, then there's very little engagement out in the real world. In the real world, for you know, like if you know how to worship a deity, there's not much employment for that. You know, there's not much employment prospects in Brahminical training, because Brahmanas live by charity, dan pratigraha. Right? These are the duties of a Brahmana: receive charity and give charity. So this is something which has to be worked on within the institution of ISKCON, is how to engage people according to their nature. Obviously, it's not that people, everyone can work in the temple and get paid by the temple. That's not practical in any way. So, in due course of time, society has to develop communities, like real communities, where everyone is engaged according to their nature. Those who are engaged, or those who are inclined towards physical work, they can work. Those who are inclined towards business, they can do business. Those who are inclined towards leadership, they can lead. Those who are Brahminical, they can teach. They can worship the deities. But it has to be done within a community. It only works within a Vaishnava community, a Daivivan ashram. Right? If you just step out into the world out there and try and find some sort of occupation which is, you know, suitable for a Brahmana, well, it's not so easy. So there's a lack of engagement. So, time is almost up. Actually, a little while ago, I had some friends, some devotees around my house. We were having prasadam, talking, having kirtan and whatnot. And we were talking about this phenomenon that once you've moved out of the temple, there isn't really so much engagement. Devotees don't feel so connected. All right? That's why it's good for me. Like, for example, I'm giving class today, right? So I'm here for a reason. You kind of need some sort of connection. So one of the devotees, I think it was Govinda, came up with the idea of a little, our own society, right? It was going to be called, he was just joking, but he was going to be called ISKCON Extra, okay? So extra stands for ex-temple residents association, all right? So we're going to have our own little movement, right? We have our own movement within a movement. So you can join once you move out. No, you don't move out. Don't move out. Just stay here. All right? So, but it's a phenomenon. It is a problem that there's a lack of engagement. So that's something that needs to be addressed. Because otherwise, you know, all the training that you do in the temple, it kind of becomes worthless once you move out of the temple. And then you have to just go and do something else. Like, devotees end up, I don't know, driving taxis, driving buses, working in libraries. All right? Whatever it is. But you do something which has got nothing to do. Like, so if you spend, say, for example, you spend 10 years in the temple and you've learned so many things, and then you're out in the world going to work, then what's the use? Like, you can know, you can know the whole bag of Gita off by heart, but what's that going to do for you? You know, out in the world. So you've trained for a job, as it were, as a brahmana. But then there are no positions vacant. All right, there's no jobs available as brahmanas out in the real world. So this is something that has to be addressed. Anyway, so it's 8:30 now. I have some more things to talk about, but I think I'll just leave those alone. And thank you for listening. You are very tolerant. Please excuse me. A couple of weeks ago, Premana Bapuri gave class, and he was saying at the beginning that, he said, I haven't given class for about 7 months, I'm a bit rusty. So I haven't actually given a class on Srimad Bhagavatam in about 10 years. Literally, about 10 years since I gave class. So, I'm more than a bit rusty. So please excuse me if I said anything stupid. Please forgive me. And Hare Krishna, Srila Prabhupada ki. Jai. Jai. Kantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki. Jai.